Hey, everybody, and welcome to another podcast of Books We Pretend to Read. My name is Gunnar Berger. I'm your host today, and with me is Jim Flannery. So, Jim, thanks again for joining me as my co-host for this podcast.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
The book we're doing today is a book called Company of One, Why Staying Small is the Next Big Thing for Business by Paul Jarvis. This book was recommended to me by my friend Dane Young. Dane Young is joining us today from the West Coast, out in sunny California. Dane actually recently quit his job as a consultant in my field. And Dane is a CTP. I think you're probably, an MVP? And you're probably one of the VMware ones too, I would imagine. I don't know if that's true though, Dane. Is that true?
Not MVP at this stage.
You don't have MVP?
Yeah.
Really?
VMware and NVIDIA.
Oh, you got the NVIDIA one?
Yeah.
Okay. So he's a very well-known personality in the space. Dane and I became quick friends, I think, probably about 4 years ago. I know we knew each other prior to that, but I think 4 years ago I was doing a big silly thing at Synergy. Actually, it was me and NVIDIA doing it. And of all the CTPs, you're the one that showed up and made sure that I was successful. And I was forever appreciative of that. So to this day, thank you for that. That was pretty awesome of you.
That's awesome.
But so the reason we're talking today is because I've been doing this podcast for almost a year now. And you recommended this book, Company of One, to me. And basically said, it came because I said, Dane, I want you on the podcast because I like your story. As, you know, an expert in the field, you have built a big brand and name around yourself. And then to actually leave a nice comfy job to go do your own thing. And it's an interesting story. I hope more than half this podcast is devoted to that because I want that portion of it, not just, you know, the book heavy portion of this thing. So Company of One is a book that really goes against the grain as far as a lot of the books that we've read so far in the podcast. You know, they're about entrepreneurship, they're about business, but the crux of this book, you know, if I were to take one sentence out of the entire thing to sum up the whole thing, it would be that scaling is not always the right answer for business. Which goes against, I'd say, the majority of my MBA, because everything is how do you scale? And by the way, this isn't about anti-scale, but it's more about scaling in a way that doesn't increase your expenses as a company. So he looks at scaling as something to, maybe I'm saying, scaling is not the right word to use, is it, Jim? It's not that he doesn't want you to scale the business. He wants you to scale it, but not necessarily with human resources. Is that?
Well, so I think he uses this term of scale as a bad thing or a dirty word. And I feel like what he's really arguing for, or what hopefully you got in your MBA, I don't know, I didn't get one of those, should be efficiency.
Don't you teach MBAs?
Scale. Yeah.
Okay. I'm sorry, I didn't actually do a good job intro Ewing. I'm sorry, Jim Flannery is my co-host this summer. For those that maybe didn't listen to the previous podcast, Jim actually teaches entrepreneurship at University of Georgia. And Jim and I have known each other because he started a angel fund in Athens and a tech hub in Athens called For Athens. Actually, that's how I first knew your name. Now, it just occurred to me. I was listening to PBS. I was driving into work one day, listening to you know, the PBS station from UGA, and you were on it talking about For Athens. That's the first time I heard about you. And now you're sitting in my basement. How the world goes. Very strange. Anyway, Jim's with me all summer. Chuck is out. He just changed jobs. He's got some stuff going on that's just kind of prevented him. He just kind of asked me to, you know, grab Jim for the next couple episodes, and Jim is more than happy to stand up. So Dane, if you were hoping to get Chuck, we'll just have to do that another time. You're getting my friend Jim.
That's all right.
And Jim's awesome, especially around the subject of entrepreneurship.
Sorry, Dane.
That's all right. It's all right. Hanging out with another MBA and somebody that teaches business is always a pleasure.
Okay, so let's get back to this. So the book, Company of One, you were saying that...
He looks at scale as this bad, dirty thing. And I really think that what he's arguing for and what most companies that try to get big look for really is efficiency. I just had a lot of problems, but I feel like I have a lot of problems with a lot of these books.
I'm excited. Because this book, I think, is a lot more in my mentality.
I would agree.
I'm sorry, Dane, go ahead.
Oh, I was just saying, I would agree. This book really spoke to me on a lot of different levels and kind of put to words what I believed about myself and the way that I've interacted with businesses for the last probably 5 or 10 years, being really intentional about it. And it's just kind of put that into words. And I've read some of the other books that you talked about on the podcast in the past, like Tim Ferriss, 40-Hour Work Week and things like that. And it just doesn't resonate with me, but this book in particular.
So that's the one I know we're going to talk a lot on this podcast, because that book seems so parallel to this book. But Jim's got something dying to say.
Dane, did you read this book before you decided to go out on your own? Like, was this the impetus for deciding, hey, I'm going to take the leap?
It wasn't. So I have a tech mastermind group that I'm a part of, a couple other entrepreneurs and self-employed individuals in this tech space. And, you know, we were meeting on a Friday morning type discussion, and somebody had brought up this book because I was talking about other related books. And they're like, oh, yeah, you really got to read this, especially before you expand and grow and scale and add employees and overhead and blah, blah, blah. You really got to read this. So as I, you know, had ordered it, started reading the first chapter or so, that's when I was at Gunnar's house about 2 months ago or so. And he's like, hey, I want to have you on the podcast. I'm like, great. I just started reading this book that we definitely should talk about. So that's kind of how this whole thing came about.
And what's sort of the broad 30,000 foot view takeaway for you on this book? Why do you think it's such a good book for people going out on their own to read?
I think even for people that aren't going out on their own, there's a lot of good nuggets in this book about just owning it, as it relates to your own career, your own destiny, your professional, path and journey. Things like, entrepreneurship, which is something that I strongly believed in for many years when I was working inside of another company, just more or less taking control of your own destiny and path, not waiting for somebody else to set the path in front of you of saying, this is the ladder that you're going to climb, but actually charting your own course and saying, no, this is the direction I'm going, whether there's alignment or agreement to the company or not. This is, things that I believe that are in the best interest of the company as a whole. So even for people that aren't planning on going out on their own, creating their own company and staying small or intentionally growing, with purpose, I think this book has a lot of good nuggets in there.
Yeah, I think it's got good nuggets. And like you mentioned, the Tim Ferriss book is the one that came to mind the most for me. Reading this is when Chuck and I did that podcast, I remember that he called it bro science. And I always, that stuck with me because it's just a funny term. And so Chuck, to say that. But I agree with it. It's like a lot of that book came off of almost sleazy to me. Like he's, you know, this pill, like his whole thing is he like sells these health pills or something. And he wants to scale the whole company. But the way that book came off was kind of a make it so you don't do anything, right? Just build a company around an idea and then outsource literally everything. So all you have to do is 4 hours and, you know, the company runs itself type thing. I don't know, something about the way that book is written and the way it comes across to me is almost like the antithesis of who I am, of like, no, I'm a hard worker. I like working hard. I like the challenge. But I also like the points that he was trying to make in that book. And what I think this author does a better job with is about focusing on the things that matter. And in this author's case, it's about, you know, the time he wants to spend with his family, that he doesn't mind if he has to work on a Saturday, but that means he's hiking in a mountain on Wednesday. I think I told this story in the 4-Hour Work Week podcast, but my first date with my wife was midweek because I was running my own business. I was a company of one at the time. And you know, some of my most busy hours sometimes were at night, because if you're working with enterprise, it's often easier to do it after hours. So I couldn't have like a typical date, but we had a nice, you know, lunch date. And I've always liked that aspect of entrepreneurship for me, is that my hours are really 100% defined by me. And oftentimes, you know, I'm a late night owl anyway. So if I've got to work the midnight shift and get to charge 2x my normal rate because it's a midnight shift and enterprises are used to that, well, good for me. I just had fun during the day. I enjoyed my time. So this book, I really felt like I was reading the 4-Hour Work Week just without the part of in that book that I didn't like. And like I said, I wasn't against Tim Ferriss's message in the book. It was the delivery of it, whereas I thought this delivery was much better. But one thing I want to get at, Jim, because, you know, you're the business school person, is there was a point in the book, and I forget which point it was, but it made me cringe because it, when he's starting to make this more controversial statement about don't scale, don't grow, scale's the wrong word, don't grow, you know, purposely set out not to grow your business above a certain level. I felt like everything that I had been trained for, which was, you know, VC and scale and how, you know, how you, you know, take $1, turn it to $10 type of thing. His approach seemed the opposite in many ways. And in fact, his approach is more akin to my approach when I first started my business, which is why I liked the book, because I looked at my first business as something very simple. I had a mortgage. I knew how much I spent on everything else, meaning food and entertainment. I was single, so it was a lot easier back then. And I had that similar story to his. Is like I had that one customer that I had one or two customers right off the bat. And by having them sign contracts, I knew I had enough money to cover my expenses. And I've always enjoyed that approach to business building, but everything in business school was almost laughable if I took that approach, that bootstrap approach. I mean, this whole book should just be called Bootstrapping a Business.
Yeah, but listen, yeah, like 90%+ of businesses do exactly what you did. I don't know why we need yet another book to tell us about this. The sort of harping on, hey, you know, most people start a business to make it huge and VC backed is just not borne out by the data, where so few companies are ever backed by VC funding. And so this seems like a very, and maybe, you know, you have the same opinion because you were around a lot of people in an MBA program who also wanted to scale a massive business.
But build $1 billion business. Yeah.
But like, that's like the tiniest fraction of people. Most people who start a business start it to pay for their expenses. And so, you know, the overarching theme for me here was that he talked a lot about this theory of, you know, love your customer, know your customer, and then you'll be profitable. And I wish business was that easy, but I think there's a lot better books if you want to think about the tactics behind the theory of loving your customer, so customer discovery. And there just wasn't a lot of takeaway for me in this about how do you make that leap.
I will say this, nothing I read in this book was new. I can't think of a single takeaway. It was a lot of, like I said, a 4-hour work week. It was almost a copy of that in many ways. And all it was is kind of more stories to back it up. But even some of his stories didn't line up with what he was talking about. And, you know, he's talking about a company of one, and then the story is a company of 20. And so that's where I think what Dane, also what you're talking about, is that company of one is more the mantra, I guess, than it is like a noun, right? It's not a true company of one. It's more of that how I strategize building a business. And to your point, Jim, is that most businesses do exactly that. Dane, I'm assuming that's exactly what you did. In fact, Dane, why don't I stop for a second? Dane, I'll tell a little bit more about your story as far as why you started it, maybe, or how you started it, how you looked at financials behind that. If you don't mind, let's just dive into you a little bit.
Sure. I think, like a lot of us, talking about ourselves is sometimes the hardest thing to do. But I've had a lot of time to think about what I wanted to do with my life and how I wanted to pursue some of my career ambitions. And it kind of started about 15 years ago. I'm going to skip a lot of the details, but it started about 15 years ago. My first real entree into the tech field was working as an apprentice and making peanuts, but had this really senior guy that took me under his wing as his disciple, if you will, and protege to learn all of the things around tech consulting. And he had a small team. He had, you know, what, as Paul Jarvis would define, he had a company of one. He had less than a dozen people that were all very much entrepreneurial in helping him grow and scale his consulting business. And this was right around the 9/11.com boom type of time frame. And I just remember being a young kid and thinking, man, this guy's got it all. He's, you know, he's able to go out, work with a variety of different customers, do consulting work for them, fly all over the place, blah, blah, blah. And I just kind of got hooked, if you will, on the whole consulting lifestyle. So, you know, from that point, you know, going through getting my bachelor's degree, and then later my master's degree, getting a full-time IT work, I just always have seen that, you know, first love has always called me back and said, you know, you just need to get the right level of experience so that you can then go do the tech consulting thing. But it's always been my dream or vision, if you will, to be self-employed, to build my own company. And the entrepreneurial gene goes, you know, way back to, you know, mowing lawns and, you know, doing tech PC repair type of stuff while working through college and things like that. So for the last dozen or so years, I've worked for other companies, worked in internal IT and then managed services providers. And for the last 8 or 8.5 years before launching out on my own, was working for a large consulting firm in the virtualization and cloud space. And more or less defined my own path there. I started as a relatively junior member of the team, as a consultant in the field, and over time just grew my skill set and got to the point where I was leading a lot of the virtualization and cloud architecture and team mentorship and things like that. But still had this desire in the back of my head, you know, what would it look like if ... And a lot of things that he talks about in this book, you know, they were really speaking to me because these were things that I kind of knew intrinsically, but didn't have a book to kind of follow or a path to follow. And this is, you know, that if you're going to be a company one, an entrepreneur, you have to have more than just whatever the skills of your craft is. It's all of the other generalist type of stuff that you have to fill in your skill set around. And the last year, probably the best example of, you know, me taking this on and owning this part of, you know, the entrepreneurship, taking control of your destiny. The last year before I actually left the company, I approached management and said, you know, I'd like to take a transition in my journey here at the company and take on a full-time sales role and actually, you know, carry a bag as an account manager, manage my own customers, still be very technical because that's my background, but manage the relationships with the customers. And that experience, more than, you know, the 10 or so years of learning all the technical craft, that sales experience that I took head on with virtually no real background or experience in sales took a big giant leap off the cliff, certainly from a salary and compensation perspective. It was huge risk, you know, both for myself and my family. And then getting that experience really gave me that confidence that, yeah, I can do this. You know, I've got the skills, the soft skills, the required relationship management skills, things like that, that'll help to advance my relationships with the clients beyond just the, you know, here's the architecture, the solution that we're going to build for you, which I, you know, I kind of learned that over the years of working in the tech field. So when I launched, I felt like I was a lot more prepared. I had more of the sales and the marketing and the business development type of aspects of growing a business that were necessary for me to have that level of confidence.
What about the financial side of it? So I get what you're saying. Like in one sense, you are the product, right? So you had the technical side, but I just like in the product world, there can be companies out there have great products, but since they have no marketing skills or no ability to sell it, then it wouldn't matter. That thing would sit on the shelf. So you're kind of looking at yourself in the same vein that, yeah, I am the product, but now I'm going to go take the sales role on because I need to learn how to get that product to market better, how to build those relationships, that kind of thing. But there is a point in time that you had to make. It's like, okay, I've got this paycheck coming in. It's steady every month. And you had to look at it. I kind of would like to know more there. It's like, what were the specific things that you looked at? Was it this type of approach in the book of I looked at what my expenses were and I went out and found that first business? What did that look like for you?
Yeah, for me, I think, it really helped that this wasn't something that was just, you know, a whim, if you will. A lot of other self-employed folks, happen upon that almost by chance or accident. You know, it's not uncommon to have people that get laid off and then go, oh, I guess this was the, moment that I was waiting for to close the store so I could go pursue my passion of being self-employed. That really wasn't, you know, my story. I had, a goal or aspiration for probably a good solid 5 years, really right around the same time that I got the first industry acknowledgement, which was a Citrix technology professional, be one of 50 people in the world. I was like, you know, that's that's probably a good baseline of recognition to give me the confidence that I can go sell myself and my product. So just kind of having that in the back of my mind for the last probably 5 years or so, and then having that be a constant conversation with my wife and I, and, you know, our family finances and planning to make sure that we had a good nest egg and money set aside, because it wasn't going to, you know, hit the ground running. I actually expected there was going to be about 4 months of dry spell, not just, you know, work not coming in, but just because of the way that mid-market and enterprise work. By the time you do the work and then you invoice and then net 30, that turns into net 60 and so on. Like, you have to have enough cash flow to be able to float that. And that was something that I attribute a lot of that knowledge to, you know, both parents that were entrepreneurs and seeing others that had gone out in the space, and then having a mastermind community of people that were self-employed that kind of gave me pointers and like, hey, these are some things that you're going to need to be paying attention to and make sure you've got enough set aside to cover these lulls in just the way that accounting systems work.
And I think that, you know, your story there is the way most people should approach entrepreneurship. I heard someone talking about it. You know, entrepreneurs aren't risk takers so much as they are people who attempt to de-risk a situation before they go out and profit from it. And that story, I think, highlights that. I think in the book, the one thing that I thought was useful was when he talked about the skill that you have, you do very little. I think he said less than like 50% of the time. And most of the time is spent on things like bookkeeping and sales. And so I think in that sense, Dane, you're a little bit unusual, although it shouldn't be that way, that you learned all of these other skills before you took the leap.
I sure as heck didn't. When I started my business, I had no idea. I know I've shared the story with probably one or both of you at this point in time, the whole accounting story, which he says at the very end, like, these are the things you should get, like, get a lawyer on retainer, get an accountant. Accountant was like still the biggest thing for me as far as a learning experience goes, is that I was trying to do everything. It's like, I can run QuickBooks. Sure. I can invoice. Sure. I can, you know, figure out marketing. There were so many things that I just, you know, did everything, but accounting is the one that just bit me so hard in the butt, because there's so many different tax laws that you don't even realize exist, from federal to state to payroll, the sales tax. It's everything is different. And trying to keep up with that. And I still have it. I'm sure I can put my hands on it in 2 minutes if I wanted to. The $500 fine I have for failing to report that I owe no money to the IRS. That kind of stuff. It just, yeah.
I think I'm still getting billed for a fine that I didn't pay for not reporting income.
Right. It's, yeah. Well, no, that's not reporting income is one thing. It's like, no, I didn't owe anything. Like, there was zero. It says right there, amount due was zero. Fine was like $200 something. It was ridiculous. But I do have one follow-up question, Dan, because you said you had 4 months of runway as what you expected. What did it end up being for you?
Less than 30 days. It was a very quick turnaround. And that was very much a surprise to me. You know, the fact that I was so well-recognized in the industry, within 2 days of being out on my own, I had a contract that booked me through the end of the year. And this was like 6 or 7 weeks of full-time work at that point. And then that kind of continued from there. So, you know, the cash flow wasn't as big of a deal. Having that confidence and that knowledge in the back of my head that things are going to be okay, if that was an issue, that definitely put a lot of ease to the situation, especially, you know, for people like me that have a wife or kids or other expenses. And, you know, in our household, I'm the sole breadwinner. My wife stays home and does homeschooling and stuff with our kids. So having that type of guaranteed buffer, if you will, to cover the household expenses was probably the most important thing that gave me confidence. There's nothing that's more stinky than a desperate salesperson.
Dane, how long have you been out on your own doing this?
This is November of last year. So it's about 8 months or so now. And it's been gangbusters. It's been phenomenal.
So my big follow-up for you, and I think I question you about this every time we talk about your business, Because what you're doing is the same thing I did. I ran my own business for, it was between 3 and 4 years before I sold it. But it was the issue I have, and I think what this book talks on and what 4-Hour Workweek talks on and what you and I have talked about is how do you do what you do at scale? And one of the issues that I have not gotten back into the service industry, in fact, a friend of mine in my MBA, at Christian, he was the first person to do the podcast with us. He was asking me, hey, do you want to do this security startup with me? And I got more information about it. And it was the same problem that I saw with his, which is that it's all about billable hours. And I didn't see his pitch on how do you scale that? And that's the same question I have for you is how do you scale that? Because this book and 4-Hour Workweek, it talks about how do you make money when you're not physically out somewhere doing something. And that was a problem in my business. So what I ended up having to do is hire employees that weren't paid very well. And then I had those contracts that were, I had some contracts out there that were maybe about 100 to 125 an hour. And they were, you know, my printer is broken type stuff. It wasn't a very high skill set. So I had people that made 20, 25 bucks an hour that would handle those lower level contracts. But the scale of that, and what I don't like is I've seen what happens at scale on a company like this, because at a company I used to work at, they ended up having to lay off about 14 people. And this was probably a 30-person company. So this was huge because, you know, some contracts go bad or they, you know, they ramp up because they're expecting revenue to hit these marks. That doesn't happen. And so then you have to pull back. And that is one of my biggest issues with the services business. And one reason why, when I think about entrepreneurship for myself, I immediately shut down what you're doing. Because you're doing what I used to do. And yeah, I could go and I could get recertified and start doing technical stuff again. But that's where that MBA side of me does come out, is that I want to find ways where what I read about in the 4-Hour Workweek, what I read about in Company of One can be true, because the value to me in doing that isn't the financial value. If I'm going to do financial value, I'm stay where I am. The value to me is owning my time. And I'm sure that's of interest to you, but the only way I can own my time is when it is not a one-to-one relationship between money coming in to me being directly responsible for work. So can I throw that back at you, Dane? Is like, what are some things that maybe you've learned or picked up as far as how you get revenue when you're not physically sitting in right now? You're spending 1 hour on me on a podcast that's going to reach maybe 1,000 people. It's, you know, it's not a very big podcast here. So you're spending an hour of your time. I'm not paying you for it. So how do you justify that? Is it marketing that you're thinking of, or is it just, you have other ways that you make sure there's a steady flow of income?
Great questions. I think, you know, the book talks a lot about this, and it's definitely something that I really latched onto, is, you know, the autonomy and the flexibility that provides. You know, that was probably one of the biggest motivators for me. It's not so much that I have a problem with authority, because legitimately and genuinely, I don't. I don't have any problem with whoever somebody sets out to say, you're going to, you know, report to this person and they're going to set your path and your direction, et cetera. But at a certain point, there just comes a point where you're just like, you know, I feel like for me, I have the best method to manage my time, to manage my resources, to do what's right for me in the business. Can't I just do that? And just having that constantly in the back of my head was probably the main motivator for me. Not, you know, riches and fame and fortune and all of that, because frankly, like you're saying, Gunnar, there's probably about half a dozen other positions out there for me that would actually be a really good fit, where I'd probably be making more money. And, you know, have stock options and bigger corporate investments, blah, blah, blah. But for me, it was just that autonomy of being able to say, you know, this is my business. I'm pursuing my passion, pursuing my dream of entrepreneurship, can be able to put, you know, more than anything on my LinkedIn and in my resume that I'm an entrepreneur. That's like that key word of something that is just always struck to my core of that's who I am. That's what I'm all about. So for like the time management side of things, this goes back to what Jim was talking about. Most companies are not companies that can support outside investment. They're what people would define as a lifestyle business or something that is built organically bootstrapped in a lot of cases that are purely there to cover the expenses and the lifestyle of the owners and be able to seed back in their investment to retirement and other things. So this very much for me is a lifestyle business. And as such, I recognize that one, I'm a workaholic. And so given the opportunity, if my wife wasn't constantly hounding me, I would probably work 80 to 100 hours a week and be perfectly fine with it. Certainly, if I didn't have a family and kids, that's the lifestyle that I would likely have. I probably wouldn't have much fun out of work, but I also, like you, Gunnar, I get a lot of fulfillment and joy out of the work that I do, you know, focused on technology. It's a passion of mine. So naturally, any passion that you have, you can work and feel like you're not working. So for me, it was important going into this thing that I actually put boundaries around my time and put structure in place so that I wasn't allowing myself to just work like a dog. And I've had a couple conversations with friends that are like, yeah, but you're working now more now than you were before, right? And the answer is no, I'm actually not. And here's why, because I'm able to make more relative to the amount of time that I'm putting in. So that gives me the flexibility to say, I don't need to work as much. And yeah, maybe I'm taking, you know, 20 to 30% less annual revenue than I could if I was working that many more hours. But what am I sacrificing in the middle of that? So keeping that flexibility around there for lifestyle, knowing that there is overhead, there's things that I have to do as part of my business that I wouldn't have to do as if I was working for somebody else. Like, everybody hates expenses and timekeeping. Well, as a business owner, get over it. Your accounting is like that times 10, right? The things that you have to do for all of the day-to-day bookkeeping and accounting is a lot more than what most people get frustrated about with, you know, expenses and timekeeping in their system. So yeah, those were little bits and pieces of, like, for me, it was structuring things so that, you know, I can take time off and, you know, I do still notify my clients and let the people know that I have obligations to. I'm going to be off these days and put it in the calendar, invite the people that are affected, make sure that they see it on their calendar so that when they email me and they get an out of office response or they call me and I don't respond, there's at least something as a heads up that, you know, this was planned and it's not, you know, an unexpected absence.
So I believe that, you know, the time freedom aspect that you're talking about is huge. And it's a big draw for a lot of people. I believe it's hard to find that balance. I think that you're incredibly lucky, skillful. I don't know what the word is that you want to use there to have been able to find that so quickly. Maybe maturity is the right word in figuring that piece out. My concern in what you just mentioned there is, you know, most people go after this lifestyle business. I wonder if you think that there's a sunset on most lifestyle businesses. Do they die 10 years, 20 years, do they have to die? Do they only die because the, you know, founders leave?
Oh man, there was a really good example in the book about that. What was that Japanese company that they brought up that's been around for like 1300 years or something like that?
Was it the hotel or the temple building company?
It was the temple, the construction company that made temples.
Yeah.
That was insane. And I don't know. I don't think that's necessarily the answer that I was aiming at. But, you know, I think, you know, my family and even going back to my great grandparents, they had an industry business that actually did a bunch of manufacturing in the World War era. And that was a lifestyle business. It was self-funded. It was bootstrapped, all of that kind of stuff. And then, you know, eventually they got to a point where the founding members were ready to sunset it. And then they passed it along to the next generation. And then the next generation decided that they didn't want to continue in the business and they ended up selling it. So I don't think there's a natural expiration. I think that there's a maturity of the services that are offered and a natural backfilling or supplement for those services. So for example, what Gunnar's talking about, you know, how do you grow and scale this business? Well, for me, the main value prop that I provide to my customers is not the here's the screenshots of all the configurations that we're going to perform on this project for your objectives. It's more of the strategy, more of the business relationship side of things to understand what their initiatives are and help them put together a plan that gets them from A to Z relative to the technology. As a result, the actual the keyboard work, the configuration work, some of those items that can be scaled, much like they're talking about in this book, Company of One, through a variety of methods, whether those are W-2 employees or subcontractors, whatever that may be. But the value that the business provides is still the same. It's that strategic technologist that's helping develop the roadmap and then bringing in the right resources to actually execute on a tactical level. That's where I've seen that in a short term, I've been able to be very successful, is that I don't have to have all of my time tied up in the tactical work of the configurations related to that project that lines up to their strategy. I know that I've jumped ahead of, you know, how much time it was going to take me to get to that point. And I've told a couple people that, you know, about 8 months into my business, I'm legitimately where I thought that I was going to be, hopefully about 2 to 3 years in. So I think I had a very realistic expectation of, like, you know, that there was going to be some seasons of drought and some things that weren't going to come along very quickly. But it's just, it's over exceeded some of my expectations. So the scaling side of things comes from not being the one that has to be directly involved in every day-to-day activity around the tactical, but defining what is the purpose, what is the value, what is it that you're providing, and is that something that is defined purely by your time allocated to a function? And if it's not, then you can find ways around that.
So here's the theory that I want to throw out on Company One that I'd like both you, Dane, and Gunnar to sort of challenge. I believe in hearing you speak, Dan, and in reading the book, that this Company of One model works well when you have a niche specific skill set,
which Dane has.
Yep,
absolutely.
Yep. So that's one. So you, good work, Dane. I think that in order to have that niche specific skill set, that requires continual learning, and so I think that that's one potential red flag. Meaning, you know, how long can you continue to learn? My other fear is that sort of the cycles of innovation are getting quicker if you look at kind of the business world. And so how long can you maintain your unique specific skill set, that niche skill, and out-compete? Or what does that mean for competition long-term?
This, I'm going to take this because I have a lot of feelings here and I'm not sure where Dane sits on them, but I've this is one reason why I haven't gotten back into that world, is exactly your questions. It is that as I looked around, I was kind of maybe in the top of the game. Now, like Dane would definitely be more superior than me of when I left the world. When you look around that industry, it's very rare you see someone older than 45. It's very rare. I could probably name them specifically, like within the community that Dane and I are in. Most of them are young men, and also to your point, things are moving so quickly. I was having to get multiple certifications every month, and those are expensive. It's not like I get them for free. Right. I was spending, I think, $3,000 for VMware certification, and then I have to re-up that once a year for, I don't know, $200-$300. And then that's just one certification that they offer, you know, the VCP. And then I went and got their desktop certification. Well, that's a different certification. And then my Citrix certifications, there were a bunch there. And then Microsoft certifications. And then Cisco certifications. And now, you know, if I was still in it, it'd be Nutanix certifications. And, you know, and NVIDIA. There's all of these things that, to be at the level in which Dane is at, Dane, I'm putting you on a soapbox, but you just have to accept that. You are at that level. This is why I've told you many times, like, you should be charging more than the competition. Because you are at that soapbox. There are 50 people worldwide in a multi-billion-dollar company that we give the label to of CTP, and you are one of them. This is a very big deal, right? And you've managed to get to that upper echelon of expertise within this niche community. But my concern personally, this has nothing to do with you, Dane, is I look around and I think that amount of travel that was required of me, I mean, it was basically 100%. Yeah, sure, I'd get some contracts that maybe I could do remotely, but that's only after I've, you know, established that relationship for quite some time before I'd be able to say, hey, can I do this one remotely this week? It just took a ton out of you from a travel standpoint, and just, it's one thing, the cost of the certification. It's another thing of just like, how much can I keep pumping into my brain and expecting it to retain, while at the same time, like, I don't have this magic switch that dumps out the fact that I can still recite the Office 2000, or no, is it Office 98, the product key? I can still recite this stinking thing, because I had to type it in so many times back then. And it's like, there's, I wish I could just like dump off older information, because I'm not sure how Windows 2000 information is really helping me anymore when it's, you know, 2019. But the thing is, I had to go through, you know, I was working on my MCSE back then, which now MCSE doesn't even exist, but MCSE used to be the shizzle of all certifications. And it's, that's the game that I don't like about that service field, is that all you have to do is look around and see that you're either going to be a Dane, or a Benny, or a Ruben, you know, these people that are super, sorry, Jim, I know these names mean nothing to you, but they mean something to Dane. You're either going to be in the upper echelon, and yeah, you can probably live it out there, but for the average person, I think it's just a really hard game. And that's where I came back to it, this idea of scale. And the scale, like, yeah, the book talks about scaling things out, like you don't need an HR department, you know, you don't need a full-time accountant or a lawyer. But I like what he's talking about. If I'm going to go take a month off and hike a mountain, money's still coming in. And it's one thing, Dane, your perspective is, hey, if I'm going to do 80-hour work week, well, I made 80 hours. You know, I made twice my pay, if you will, that week. So then I can create a cash buffer or runway. So then if I do want to take a month off, I can. That's not necessarily the same thing as what I would want if I were to take this type of lifestyle business. I would want it that, if, you know, more the Tim Ferriss route, that literally if I was gone, checks are still being sent and being deposited and money's still being made. To me, that's just a really hard thing. And that's one of the reasons, well, one of a couple of reasons of why I ultimately sold my company. The other reason is just simply that I did simple math of $200 an hour times 2040, which is the average amount of hours a person works in a year, was only, I think, 315,000 or something. I'm doing that for my head, so please don't do it and yell at me. But I remember it was somewhere around that number, and I'm just like, I can do better than that. But you would think $200 an hour, that's good. Dane, you'd be really happy if every hour of your life was $200. But because it sounds great, $200 an hour, heck yeah. But when you look at the grand scheme, it's like, oh, that's only 300 some odd thousand dollars. Are you about to do the math, Jim? I see you pulling up here. It's pulling up the math. You look at it like, that's, you know, that's 300 grand. And in my head, and maybe it's just my stubbornness, what is it? What's the final number?
It's a little over 400, I think. 40 hours a week, 52 maybe weeks a year. Maybe you're giving yourself a couple of vacation weeks.
The math is equal that I felt I can do better, that, you know, 200,000. And that's maybe the wrong approach, that, you know, the approach should be that it's not about how much money, it's about spending time with my kids and everything else. But I also just feel like, I can do more. And that was the other reason why I just felt like this one-to-one relationship that doesn't scale, and it caps out at what you just said, $400,000. It just doesn't, that wasn't what I want. And it's still not to this day what I want. I want to do something at larger scale than that.
But I mean, even on the product side of this, you still are up against that more and more rapid cycle of innovation that requires continual learning, that requires sort of continual rebirth.
But on the product side, if I build this thing once, I can sell it to as many people who are willing to buy it, right? And then, I got to iterate it every 18 months.
Yeah, for like 6 months, a year, 2 years, and then, you know, someone else comes along. And do you have the R&D capability or budget to continually stay up on that? And that's, you know, call me a pessimist here, but I think that it becomes harder and harder for these small companies to compete because of that. To continually reinvent what you're doing just requires this continual learning. And I don't know how long that goes on.
Well, I mean, you could look at very few of the S&P 500 or whatever index funds are more than 25 years old, right? Most companies don't make it past 25, no matter how big they are. You know, Compaq doesn't exist anymore. What was DEC? Wasn't that the big computer industry? Tandy doesn't exist anymore. You could go through a list of companies that had huge names at the time. I mean, Yahoo, I guess, still exists. But, you know, I think the book talks about like pets.com and others. Those are more of a dot-com bubble type thing. But I'm saying like legit Blockbuster. That's a good one. That one's around for a long time and that dies. So I think what you're saying is just the natural cycle of business is that to have something last longer than that is very difficult. I think certain businesses are probably more okay than that. Like my wife is a veterinarian, so you know the practice she works at, it's like 70 years old now. But I think that's it's a different, yes, science improves and we learn better ways to treat animals, but ultimately you've got a freaking pet and you need to bring it and make sure it's got its vaccines and stuff. You know, that hasn't changed that much what the doctors do on the other side does, but they're also required to constantly go and get CE credits. Well, you're married. I'm sorry, Jim, you're also married to a vet.
I mean, it sounds terrible, right? Having to continually reinvent yourself. Like right. That's the tension. Dane, have you thought of that? Like, how do you, you know, what happens in 3 years? How do you reinvent what you're doing?
Dane's crying in a corner right now.
I'm not crying in a corner, but I am trying to find the part in the book that talks about it takes a heck of a lot more than just passion. There's a good section that talks about that. I think I highlighted it, but it's this basic point that like, okay, yeah, all right, great. You're passionate about something, but you're going to still have to put in the work. And it's still going to take effort and blah, 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 blah. And when you guys were going back and forth about the product company versus the services company and building something that's scalable versus building something that's lifestyle, it's like at the end of the day, I just look at it from the perspective of at a certain point, I had to pick my poison. Was I going to have the woes of this or that? You know, there's no such thing as always upside. And there's always going to be pain and things that you have to deal with that, you know, are less than desirable, but you just plug along through it. With regards to, you know, how am I continuing to improve and how am I staying ahead of this stuff? I've had to become very, very intentional with limiting. He kind of talks about setting an upper limit and things like that. But like my time is the only thing that I have to, you know, manage and control as it relates to this business and growing and scaling. And I just remember numerous times over the close to 10 years that I was at a large value-added reseller and integration partner, at a certain point, as the virtualization practice manager, somebody that was responsible for the virtualization cloud technologies like Citrix, Microsoft, VMware, there was probably 100 vendors on our line card, all of whom had their own requirements, things that they wanted to see from engineers, things that they wanted to see from our sales, quotas that they wanted us to meet, certification requirements, just the list goes on and on and on about what Gunnar's talking about. And there was always, always this mindset in the business that if we do all of these things that are being asked of us from the vendors, that they're going to come through on all these promises that they're making. And it's, in my opinion, just a big fallacy of the field of dreams notion. If you build it, they will come. The reality is very few times does that actually work out. And more often than not, you're spinning and spinning and spinning cycles for something that doesn't actually move the needle in terms of your business. So for me, it's that whole gut check of like, you know, being able to have the agility and the decisiveness to say, these are the things that are moving the needle for my business. These are the things that are either improving my customer relationships or my revenue or whatever that may be. And then moving in that direction and having that gut instinct to say, this is how it's going to actually affect me and my business in the long term. The one thing that I would say in terms of how quickly the industry is changing is that 20 years from now, I may not look at things the same way. Legitimately, I totally get it. Gunnar and probably a couple others had said, you know, I really respect and admire what you're doing. You know, it's not easy to, you know, leave a guaranteed income, et cetera, and start your own business. It truly is a young man's game. And, you know, I'd like to think of myself still very young, but, you know, I do have a wife and kids and things outside of work that I'm very passionate and committed to that all pull on my time. And so being able to stay one step ahead of the curve is always going to be a continual challenge, especially as there are, you know, bigger, better, stronger forces out there at work. I think for me, it's been, you know, setting an upper boundary, setting an upper limit to say, I have no desire to go up and spin up 100 relationships with all these different partners, because all that's going to do is cause them to, you know, throw me into their database and start sending me the requirements of things that I need to do X, Y, and Z. And I have to get very specific about the ones that are actually going to move the needle, the ones where I can make the biggest impact with my customers, the things that customers are driving demand towards, not what do I think is going to help build my business long term, but where am I actually hearing the demand and letting that demand drive where I'm spending my time and interest, etc. For me, the type of business that I'm building is actually accelerated by the rate of change in the industry, especially around tech. And I'll kind of elaborate in this way. Again, I might not feel this way 20 years from now, but right now, I see this as a huge opportunity for me and my clients, because the majority of clients that I'm working with are just so buried with the day-to-day monotony of keeping the lights on, keeping the applications up and running, keeping the servers up and running. They don't have time to go out and be the, you know, the best and the brightest of a new technology that they're looking to implement. They need somebody that's got those skills, that can bring those skills, and that is staying ahead of where things are going, to be that advocate that can say, here's why you might not want to go down that path, or here's why you might not want to think about doing it in that way. Staying ahead of people that are just buried in their day to day, it's not actually as difficult as it sounds. And I know I'm, you know, probably downplaying it a little bit, but most of the people in IT are just completely exhausted. They're completely buried. They're working way too much, and they don't have time to stay up on all of the things that are happening out there. So if you're just incrementally better and just a little bit ahead, it goes a long, long ways. And I think I saw that, you know, the most dramatic was a couple years back. I was doing a lot of innovative projects for private companies. And then I started doing a bit more with public sector companies. And just the stark contrast there was just so real to me, where, you know, they're probably a good 5 to 7 years behind the technology curve of most every private company that's out there. So it doesn't take much to stay, you know, one step ahead of what, you know, the peers in the industry are doing.
Well, we are at an hour. I didn't do a very good job actually summarizing the book. So I'm going to do something a little bit different, because I do have a hard cutoff with my hosts here, or with my guests here. We're going to take a break. And when I come back, we're going to be solo, and I'm just going to summarize the book for the listeners here. I'll try to do it in about 10 minutes. Because there are some things that I'm actually a lot more interested in this conversation we had with Dane, who's, you know, someone living the experience of Company of One. So I'm glad we gave that focus. But I also want to stay true to the podcast of, if you haven't read the book, I want to give you a good summary on that. So we're going to take a break. We're going to say goodbye to Dane. We're going to say goodbye to Jim. So thank you guys so much for coming and joining this podcast. And Dane, thank you so much. I know I've been talking about this. I think before I even started the podcast, I think I reached out to you and said, you got to do this with me. So thanks so much for both recommending this book and for sharing your story with us today.
Awesome. Thanks for having me on.
All right. We'll be right back.
Best of luck, Dane.
Thanks, Jim.
All right, everybody. Welcome back. Sorry for I guess I'm not really sorry for the way this podcast went. It went exactly better than I hoped it would. I know I normally kind of do a summary chapter by chapter of the book, and we missed all that because we were just hearing some really good dialogue. I'm very much more interested in the application of what we're reading in these books. And so Dane living this book and Dane recommending this book, I think is even more informative than reading the book itself. But as the promise of the podcast is, we will read the books and then we summarize them for you. And I kind of skipped that. And there were some key things, especially around relationships, I wanted to get into on that. And I do have Dane still on the line because he said he had some extra time. So he might pipe in now and again on something, or I might ask him a question. So let me do this thing. So this book is broken up into three major parts. The first one is called Begin. Second one's Define. Last one is Maintain. The beginning part is, I think we've already kind of hit on this enough. It's the idea of Company of One is not necessarily one person. It's more of a mentality. We talked about that. And staying small as an end goal. And I think that's a kind of controversial statement, is that I purposely want to keep myself small. I think most people would think once I get to a certain point, I should, you know, bring on staffers and other people in order to handle the amount of internal demand for my services. And that's actually something, there was a story in the book that I liked a lot. It was a woman, and I think she was a designer, an artist of some sort. I can't remember. She made something weird though. That's where I need Jim or someone to remind me. But anyway, she had such high demand for her services. What she did is very basic economics. She increased her price right? Supply and demand. So as the price increases, the demand naturally dies down, right? This is why airplanes have first class and only a few seats in them, is that it gets so expensive that the demand wanes down. So she did that for her business. And I've often said this to Dane, I even said it earlier today, is that I look at Dane as one of the brightest minds in our industry, in the industry, I say our, Dane and I's industry, end-user computing. And so I often want him to increase his prices, but he's hit me back and just said, yeah, fine, find me some customers that are going to pay me that. And sure, I'll be happy to charge him that. So I think, and Dane, I know you're on mute. So maybe I'm already losing track of summarizing the book, but I think that over time, as Dane's skills become more out there and people realize Dane's out there doing his company of one, I think that might be a road that Dane will have to cross one day. I certainly hope it's true that he ends up having such an influx of work that he realizes he can do two approaches here. He can take on and no longer be a company of one and, you know, hire someone else that's, you know, a really sharp mind too, and start billing that person's time as well. Or he could do what the more controversial approach is that you see in this book, is to say no to that. Nope, I'm not going to do that. You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to increase my price. So I don't know what Dane, your rate is, but let's say that Dane's rate is $200. And let's say that he's got 80 hours a week times 52 weeks a year worth of work at that. And that's great. He's making good money, but he can determine, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go to 250 and let's see if that brings me down to 70 hours a week or 60. And he can actually just start cranking up that price until it affects people's willingness to pay. And which is, we talked about in the previous podcast, and to the point where he is actually making more money doing less. It actually makes perfect sense from straight economic standpoint. And the story in the book, I thought, was really kind of a cool way to show that how you purposely keep your company small. So that was one thing that I felt this book did a better job than any other book I've read on that, which I'm sure if Jim was here, he'd probably give me a hard time about that. But that was just a point they made, and I thought they did a good job making that point. So staying small as an end goal was chapter two. What's required to lead? Honestly, I don't remember what that chapter was about, so sorry about that. It's probably just talking about what we've talked about so far is, you know, if you're going to be an entrepreneur, it's not enough. I mean, listen to Dane's story. It's not enough that he's the sharp technical mind. Absolutely he's a sharp technical mind. But he, like he said, he went and became a salesperson for a while. He had to learn a lot about leadership and all the other facets of running a company beyond just this, his technical skill, which is what people pay him for. They don't pay him to be a good accountant and to invoice on time and to make sure those invoices get paid. But he, as a business owner, he needs to do that, right? That's just a part of this whole process. And the last chapter in part one is growing a company that doesn't grow. I don't know. It seems like it's probably just repeating stuff I've already said. So let's go to the next part. So part two has five chapters: determining the right mindset, personality matters, the one customer, scalable systems, and teach everything you know. The main part about part two is how you grow your business at scale. I'm saying that wrong because I keep using this word scale, and I just don't think that's the right word for most of this podcast. How you use tools that are out there to bring in customers into your business, which might seem backwards in some sense. There's like, hey, my goal is only to grow at a certain point. Yeah, but you got to get to that point, right? So you need to find ways to market your business. And he brings up newsletters is one of the number one things he talks about over and over again in this book, which was just weird to me because newsletters to me are just things that I have not figured out how to block from coming into my email yet. I very much hate all forms of email. So I just, the one with authors talking about, I know wouldn't reach with me, but I don't think I'm the typical consumer he's probably going after. I think I'm closer to like a B2B relationship. In any case, he talks about using these types of communications because they have a very good return on investment. I believe the math thing he gave was, you know, for every, or it was a 3,600% increase in return on investment for newsletters because it is so darn cheap to make. You know, it takes you nothing to write, let's say, a one-page newsletter, but then that can reach the entire world if it had all of their email addresses, right? It's like it doesn't cost anything more to make it for one person or 10,000 people. And So it makes a lot of sense from that standpoint. One of the things that I thought was the best part of part two was this idea of how you build relationships with people. In that, you know, you go to used car salesman, and I think that's all I have to actually say is used car salesman, and you immediately have a picture in your head of what this is like. Just trying to walk a lot and having someone coming up to you, talking to you. And I'm not sure who you are, but I know as a person, before I go on any lot looking at a car, I've already done so much investigation into the car that I'm interested in that I can probably school the person who is coming to try to sell me on this car. And the book talks about how car salesmen have had to actually change their strategy because of the internet and the fact that you can find a different car down the street, right? And you can find all the information you need online for that. So creating personal touches is one of the key factors they have in this book. And they tell stories of someone who literally like handwrites a letter, or maybe it's a personal email they send out to each of their customers, or another person who, I forget what they sell, but they add like a little set of chocolates to the box. I know there's the microphone I'm talking on right now was from a company called, I think it's called Sweetwater. Where's Chuck when I need him? He had me buy these things, and they always put a packet of candy in it. I know it's sweet something because there's a packet of candy inside the box. It's just that little touch. And he talks about how these touches become viral moments that, you know, there's another story of this guy. I can't remember the name of the company. I'm terrible at this. What my co-host is for. I'm very bad at those specifics. But the company, if you got a wrong size shirt, they just ship you a new one in hopefully the right size. And they want to ask for the other one in return. And not only is this really good customer service, but these creates these viral moments, because when you get that level of service, something you do not get from other businesses, that's something that people will willingly share. They become your advocates for you when you reach out and you do that good of a job for them. And I think all of us probably have those moments. And Disney World to me is one of my favorite places to go to, because I can tell you numerous occasions I've gone to Disney World and they have done something above and beyond what was required of them. In fact, my wife and I, we have a yearly tradition. We drive to Disney for Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween Party, and we take all our kids with us. The reason we didn't even know this thing existed. What happened was I had park hoppers, and I had gone to one park all day, and we're like, okay, we still got 2 hours left. Let's hop over to the Magic Kingdom. Let's do 2 hours of Magic Kingdom. And this is just the two of us, no kids. And when we get to Magic Kingdom, they were closing the park, and we went up to the customer service rep and said, what's the deal? The park's not supposed to close for 2 hours. We have park hoppers. We're here. And they said, oh, I'm sorry. We close it for this, special party that we do, this Mickey's Not So Scary Halloween Party. And, while they were trying to figure out stuff for me, they gave us two tickets. Now, if you know anything about Disney, these are very expensive tickets. They gave us two tickets for this party, and they apologized to us. They said, I'm sorry, you know, whatever, we were on property, so they didn't give us the right updated time that the parks were closing. Whatever it was, it doesn't even matter. I don't remember it. What I do remember is Disney gave me free tickets, and my wife and I went into the Not So Scary Halloween Party, and we loved it. And we stayed there till midnight because they kept it open till past midnight. And we have gone with our entire family for like the past 5 years from one small thing. They lost, what, $150, maybe $200 for those tickets. But that memory stuck with me so much. When we started having kids, we brought them. And we have continued to do that year over year over year, because one cast member did something awesome. They made it special for me. And I've got a similar story of Hilton, where I my flights got all messed up. I'm traveling out of country. I think I only have my passport and my wallet's gone. So I have my ID. I can verify who I am, but I don't have a wallet. So I can't even get to the airport. I remember calling Hilton at 3 a.m. exhausted and crying. And Hilton sent a car out to pick me up. And this is, you know, pre-Uber and pre-phone. I think my phone was dead. Anyway, Hilton sent a car out, brought me in. I walk in, of course, miserable. It was like an hour drive. And Hilton, like, they're standing at the door. They hand me my room key, and they said, everything's taken care of. That was all the manager said to me. Everything's taken care of. And they said, this is your room. Go up, and have a good night. We'll figure everything out in the morning. And oh my gosh, like even right now, I'm welling up a little bit sharing that story. It cost them nothing in the sense that ultimately that was built to my room, but I couldn't pay for it myself right then and there. And that little touch, these little things that you as a small business are able to do than a large business. Like Hilton, the fact that the manager had the power to do that, that's crazy. Most large businesses don't have the flexibility. I mean, try calling technical support and getting that type of support at a large company. It doesn't happen. There's a story in the book about, I think it's Rackspace, and how the Rackspace technical representative is on the phone with the person, and they hear someone in the background about ordering pizza. My assumption here is that whatever the technical issue is, it's going to take a while. And they hear, oh, we better order some pizza because it's going to be an all-nighter type of thing. Well, what the person does at Rackspace is it puts them on hold, orders pizza, like looks up the guy's address in their, you know, CRM, and orders a pizza from whatever local pizza place, has it delivered to them. While she's still on the phone as a tech rep, the pizza walks in and they're like, who ordered pizza? And then she says, I did. Again, that is amazing to me. And of course, that story obviously must have gone viral because I'm reading about it in a book. And it cost, what, $20-$40 to do that? This is probably my favorite point of the entire book, is that this is where small business can kick big business's butt, is your absolute devotion to the customer. You know, if you've ever watched The Office, there are multiple examples of this. My favorite one being when Dwight and Jim are out doing a sales call together, and Dwight is being super annoying. He's on a phone and he's like, two. And then wait, and Jim's kind of doing his sales speech. And then you hear Dwight in the background, four. And Jim keeps doing the sales speech, kind of rolling his eyes at Dwight. And it gets towards the end of the sales speech. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. You know, the customer is saying, I'm sorry, but your prices are too high. And Jim says, you know, does customer service matter to you? And the guy says, absolutely. He goes, okay. Well, Dwight's been on the phone, with our competitor this whole time, trying to connect in with their customer support. Let me show you how hard it is with me. He picks up a phone, hits one button, and then it's the, you know, it's not Pamela. I forgot the other girl's name that was up front. She goes, hi, Jim, how's it going? You know, really bubbly, and just hangs up on her, which is a funny moment. But he showed very quickly the power of a smaller business is ability to go against a large corporation, as Dwight is still making this annoying five, you know, he's doing the automated number thing, as most call centers will make you do. So that is where I think that this book really lands very well for me, is if you're a small business, if you're a company of one, there's no bureaucratic red tape between you and an awesome customer experience. Large businesses are trying to make it so they can feel like a small business. And the book talks about this. But if you're a company of one, you are a small business. Your biggest differentiator is you, your personality. It also talks about having a stance on things, not trying to be everything to everybody. I don't know if he's talking about, you know, political stances, or to me, it'd probably be more environmental. The reason I like electric cars, and I often talk about Tesla on most podcasts, is because I'm very big into environmental standards. And not just that, I've come from a military family. I know how many wars we fought over oil. Those are my stances. And solar power and other things. Like, I'm very much about green tech. So he talks about in this book that to have those stances and to do it on purpose, because you are going to have some people that absolutely hate you because you have that stance. And then you're going to have people that like you because you have that stance. And again, you are a small business. You're not going to be able to make everyone happy. So pick your niche, because that's what you need to do. And we were talking earlier about Dane and Jim, and that Dane has his niche within this world of end-user computing. It's a multi-billion-dollar industry, but give me a break. It's very small compared, you know, Microsoft. You know, I think my company is like maybe less than 1% of Microsoft's revenue, and we're, you know, a multi-billion-dollar company. You know, in the grand scheme of things, we are not everything to everybody, and neither is Dane. He has his niche. He's very good at his niche. And that's what it's talking about, is like using the personalities, the thing that make you interesting and unique, and leveraging those. I was just on Twitter today because Doug Brown, who works at iGel, tweeted this thing of this Navy SEAL guy that like swears every other word. It's hilarious. But that guy has a very clear personality, and that's who he is. And obviously some people are not going to enjoy that, but other people's are. And that's what you want. As bad as it is, you want polarization, because you want those people that are going to be adamantly for you, and the people that are against you, you know, who cares? As long as you're really going after someone adamantly, you're giving that one person one customer your absolute attention, and bringing them into the fold and making them become advocates. So that's what I think that pretty well defines part two. Part three is maintained. So let's look at what they're talking about. Properly utilize trust and scale, launching and iterating in tiny steps, the hidden value of relationships, starting a company, one, my story. This, I think, is largely just the MVP message, which I've gone over in previous podcasts. I don't really feel like I need to do over that. He had one thing that was a little bit different, which was he called it the MVPR. So instead of a minimum viable product, he called it minimum viable profit, which is kind of what we were already talking about with Dane. I don't actually think I was able to pull out of Dane what that number was. Well, that's a kind of a personal question now that I think about it. Hey, Dane, how much money is your minimum viable profit? In that, you know, how much money do you need to make every month? Okay, I can see that's a pretty personal question. But that he's basically just, you know, talking kind of the ground up. It's like, what do I actually need to live? And, you know, my need to live, I've got a big house, big mortgage, and three kids. My need to live is probably much higher than someone that doesn't have any kids and isn't married. Like when I first started my business, my first business. The whole, you know, launching and doing tiny steps, this is standard product management stuff. So I didn't really think this was something that new in his approach. It's just, instead of, you know, he kind of redefined the minimum viable product as minimum viable profit. But still the idea is the same. It's like if he talks about how if you ask an entrepreneur what their first product looked like, they would often laugh because of how bad it was. And they say, if you don't think your first product is cringeworthy, it's because you waited too long to launch it. And I thought that was probably a good point made in there. But I think that pretty well sums it up. But yeah, I think that's a pretty good job as far as wrapping the book up. I think I took maybe 15, 20 minutes to do it, but I just wanted to make sure you got a good idea on what this book is about. Now, normally at the end of the podcast, I will close by asking who would recommend this book. So, Dana, I am going to have to ask you to unmute if you're still there. I would say I liked this book more than I liked the 4-Hour Work Week. But I think the 4-Hour Work Week is probably quicker to consume and get a lot of the same points across. I just didn't find this book as cringeworthy. I have to go back and listen to the podcast of why main thing I remember about 4-Hour Work Week is cringeworthy. But this book just seemed to have more anecdotal information, or not anecdotal, more substance to its stances on growth, on choosing choosing your customers, choosing your product, choosing who you want to be. It just seemed to be more substantial overall. It was also a lot more of a read. The book is a lot heftier than the 4-Hour Work Week, which is why, you know, 4-Hour Work Week's probably sold 6 million copies or something. But overall, if you've read 4-Hour Work Week, you probably don't need to read this book. If you haven't read 4-Hour Work Week, I would lean towards this book over the 4-Hour Work Week, just because this one wasn't cringy at all. I thought this one had a lot of substance to it. You know, Jim had already said he disagreed with the substance, because he felt like, you know, you could read a book on customer discovery to get some of those points. But I don't know. This is a beginning business book. This is not a deep dive into customer success and customer discovery. But Dane, if you're, I don't know if you're there, but I'll ask you a question. Why did you recommend this book, or would you recommend this book for others? I mean, overall impressions on this book.
I would recommend this book to others. A lot of it was intuitive and natural to me, but that doesn't mean that it's going to come that same way to a lot of other people. I think there's just a lot of good information in here about the core message being decide what kind of business you want to build and then build that business, whether that's a company that can support outside money or a lifestyle company. This book is most definitely speaking to that core message of building a lifestyle company, building a lifestyle business, something that can meet what you want to do both in the business and outside of the business while not running you ragged in the process. So I definitely had a lot of good takeaways from here. I thought, you know, a lot of the company examples that were given, those were probably legitimately from his business consulting, because he's, you know, Paul Jarvis has moved on from just web design and technical consulting to more business consulting. So this is probably a lot to do with the companies that he's talked to and some of their examples. Yeah. But there's a lot of good stuff in here, and I would definitely recommend it. Not only to somebody that's considering being an entrepreneur or starting their own business, but somebody that wants to make a more lasting or meaningful impact inside of the company where they're at.
Cool. Well, thanks for your recommendation. Thanks for joining the podcast again. I'll ask you one more question. You sat through and listened to me live do a recap on the book. Do you think I missed any important points that resonated to you but I didn't get across?
No, I think you covered it pretty well. I think overall the book has a good structure, and the way that it's broken down makes a lot of sense. I do think that he does a pretty good job of taking what we find to be common sense in the tech world and kind of distilling that down for people that are picking up his book just from a general business standpoint, not necessarily from a tech angle. So I did appreciate some of that stuff around some of the business concepts and launching early, launching often, minimum viable product, things like that, that aren't necessarily as common in the non-tech industry.
Yeah, that's true. The reason I didn't go deep detail on that is mainly because I've talked about MVP in about four different podcasts at this point in time. So he's just kind of doing similar things. So it's also a way for me to shout out to people to get them to listen to a different podcast.
I did find that section that was talking about the whole nuance of following your passion and all that. So I think it would be a good point to end on. It's page 85 in the book, and it says, "Of course, courage and passion sound better and more romantic than skills and viability tests. Courage and passion can be great if you want to skydive or take up a hobby like playing the ukulele. But when your livelihood is at stake, being courageous and following your passion should take a backseat to using the skills that you can build up and validate with revenue." And I thought that was probably the key takeaway that I had for the book, which is, just because you have a passion about something doesn't mean you have the skills to actually pull it off. And a lot of the business failing that I've observed is people that think that they can start a business because they had, you know, a mentor that started a similar business, but they don't have any skills germane to that industry. And then they try and launch and do something that's different that they don't have the technical or the business skills to back that up. So I thought that was a really good comment to leave it on.
Yeah, and that reminds me of, I think it's Mike Rowe's TED Talk. Have you listened to Mike Rowe's TED Talk?
I don't think so.
Okay. He has the same thing of don't follow your passion. And it's very much along the same vein of that. He talks about all these skilled laborers that are plumbers and mason, you know, Mike Rowe, the dirty jobs guy.
Yep.
And these people that they're passionate about their work, but they didn't start that way.
Yep.
Right. They, you know, he said one of the most passionate people I've ever met was a guy that cleaned out septic tanks. So literally, you know, cleaned up poop for a living. And obviously that wasn't something that no one would think would be your passion to grow up and clean up poop. but how focusing on something, getting a skill, your passion will follow. So it's not, Micro does a better job of, I wish I could play it as part of this podcast. But I think it's Micro's TED Talk, but it might just be, let me look real quick. I can always cut out.
Well, while you look for that, I'll go ahead and read a section that talks about that as well. It says, "While no one should ever tell us to not pursue our passions, we can't simply feel entitled to make money from them. If you're engaged by your work for the independence it allows, for the sense of completion when you're done, for its contribution to make the world a better place, passion is likely to follow. Passion isn't the catalyst that creates success. but more often what develops after success is achieved. Taking action and doing work as a first step creates momentum, and this momentum happens when you're caught up in and enjoying the process of your work, not its possible outcomes. The gist is this: you can pursue any passion you want, but you shouldn't feel entitled to make money off of it. I felt like that was like a huge mic drop moment, because it speaks to the generation in which we live.
Yeah, I think you and I have especially been lucky that our passion around technology has been able to generate our incomes. And I, by no means, this isn't, honestly, if I talk about my story, I was doing music theater in college. And I switched over to information technology within the last couple of years because I knew I needed to make money. I was good at doing, you know, technical stuff, but it wasn't my passion. And it was by focusing on that, being in IT, and messing with the latest technology, where, you know, now technology is like the center of our culture in so many ways, but it wasn't when I started out. It's just kind of been kind of cool to watch that shift occur. And now the thing that makes me money is, you know, it's a pretty cool thing. It's a pretty fun thing to be a part of. So, and if you are interested, go on YouTube and type in "Don't Follow Your Passion," Mike Rowe. It's a great little 5-minute video he gives on exactly this message and it sounds counterintuitive, don't follow your passion, but I'll let Mike do it because I do a terrible job at it. But and on that note, we're gonna close it. So thank you again, Dane. Jim, who had to take off, thank you so much, Jim. And I hope you enjoyed this podcast. We'll see you on the next one. Have a good day.
Thanks, everyone. We'll be right back.